The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Yesterday, Hillary Clinton locked up her nomination for president on the Democratic side, the Democrats' ticket, which means the United States has now settled on two of the most despised presidential candidates in American history. That's what we have. This is what it's whittled down to out of 320 or 30 million people. It's down to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Joel Hilliker wrote about this in the latest Trumpet magazine, July 2016, where he said American voters will now choose between two of the most loathed presidential candidates in history. The factor that determines the next president will likely be which one voters hate less. Cynicism, pessimism, even fatalism hang like a pall over much of the electorate. On the other side, with Mr. Trump, you have a lot of people in the Republican Party who now seem to have a bit of buyer's remorse with all the comments that he's made recently about the Mexican judge in the Trump University case, basically saying that he's disqualified because he's a Mexican. And Trump has since backed away from that a little bit. In any event, there's some who came out in support of him who are now saying, well, look, we better threaten to withdraw that support unless he changes his tune. Joel Hilliker writes, every 4 years, Americans get swept up in political promises of hope and change, reform, shaking things up, taking the country back, making America great again. And then we're disillusioned for another 4 years. Now, this time around, many people seem disillusioned even before the general election campaign has begun. The slogans are ringing hollow, even for many partisan voters. And then there's some saying, let's just sit this one out. Disillusionment has set in, even before the election. Mr. Hilliker covers some history in his piece about other transformations in nations, in government, the big promises that come along with the movements. The French Revolution in 1789, he says, or with the Bolsheviks in 1917, or the Iranian hardliners that came to power in 1979, or the Nazis in Germany there in 1933, or more recently, the Islamic State. I mean, none of these movements came along and said, hey, you know what, we're going to really try to destroy the nation, or we're just going to stick with the status quo. They all come along promising to fix the problems of this world or of their respective regions. And Mr. Hilliker says here, among these innumerable experiments in governance, the Republic of the United States stands as the greatest. This is the greatest experiment in human history. What a noble experiment it was for the founders to set out to establish one nation under God, under God's authority, with freedom and liberty and equality promised for all, equality of opportunity. One nation under God. This is something, this idea, that many today are embarrassed by, particularly among the radical left. Secretary of State John Kerry, this is a couple of years ago, talking about this idea of American exceptionalism, this greatest of human experiments, as Joel Hilliker brings out. Secretary of State Kerry said in 2014, "I get always a little uptight when I hear politicians say how exceptional we are. Not because we're not exceptional, but because it's kind of in your face. And a lot of other people are exceptional. A lot of other places do exceptional things. So it's not just America. And so we need to tone down the rhetoric and not say those kinds of things." Just to give you a simple definition of American exceptionalism, this is something that Ben Shapiro wrote a couple years ago. He said, "American exceptionalism stands for the proposition that liberty from government and property rights, combined with an underlying Judeo-Christian ethos, creates freedom not just at home, but the hope for freedom around the globe. American exceptionalism is the philosophy of self-confidence that freed Europe twice, that ended slavery at the cost of hundreds of thousands of American lives, that fought for freedom, freedom of Koreans and Vietnamese and Iraqis." This idea, though, really, really offends radical leftists who repeatedly want to see America brought down a few notches. They want to see America on the same playing field, a level playing field, with Greece or with Ukraine or Crimea or Nicaragua, or just go down the list. What Secretary of Kerry said there in 2014, by the way, it parallels what President Obama said about American exceptionalism while he, let's see, this was in 2009.
"I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I suspect that the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism."
He said that just a few months after being elected president. And I mean to say, there were people in the Republican wing that were up in arms about this statement. Newt Gingrich, he came out and said what President Obama said there was truly alarming. He was alarmed by it. And then leading into the 2012 campaign, the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, he said, "Our president doesn't have the same feeling about American exceptionalism that we do. He doesn't think about America. He doesn't think about this noble experiment the same way that most of the rest of us do." In fact, that party, the Republican Party, was so up in arms about these remarks, about the sentiments expressed by Kerry in 2014, President Obama in 2009, that they made one of the party platform's seven sections. It was built around this idea, American exceptionalism. This is from the 2012 GOP party platform heading into the convention just 4 years ago. It says, "We are the party of peace through strength, professing American exceptionalism, the conviction that our country holds a unique place in and role in human history. We proudly associate ourselves with those Americans of all political stripes who more than three decades ago, in a world as dangerous as today's, came together to advance the cause of freedom, repudiating the folly of an amateur foreign policy and defying a worldwide Marxist advance. They announced their strategy and the timeless slogan we repeat today, peace through strength, an enduring peace based on freedom and the will to defend it, and American democratic values and the will to promote them." It says here, "Well, the 20th century was undeniably an American century, with strong leadership, adherence to the principles of freedom and democracy, our founders enshrined in our nation's Declaration of Independence and Constitution, and a continued reliance on divine providence. It said the 21st century will be one of American greatness as well. Pretty optimistic. It's only going to get better. Of course, it implied there that it has to be grounded in the foundational documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the continued reliance on divine providence. As I said just 4 years ago, many Republicans were so upset. They were so upset by the direction the Obama administration was taking this country, the United States, that they had this idea, American exceptionalism, locked into the GOP party platform. Well, now that Donald Trump is the Republican candidate for president, you wonder if they're going to have to erase that particular section from the 2012 party platform. This is what Mr. Trump said about a year ago.
Define American exceptionalism. Does American exceptionalism still exist? And what do we do to grow American exceptionalism?
Okay, well, I don't like the term. I'll be honest with you. And people will say, oh, he's not patriotic. Look, if I'm a Russian, or if I'm a German, or if I'm a person we do business with, why, you know, I don't think it's a very nice term. We're exceptional. You're not. First of all, Germany's eating our lunch. So they say, why are you exceptional? We're doing a lot better than you. I never liked the term. And perhaps that's because I don't have a very big ego and I don't need terms like that. But honestly, when you're doing business, I mean, I watch Obama every once in a while say American exceptionalism. I don't like the term because we're dealing, first of all, I want to take everything back from the world that we've given them. We've given them so much. On top of taking it back, I don't want to say we're exceptional. We're more exceptional. Essentially, you're saying we're more outstanding than you. By the way, you've been eating our lunch for the last 20 years, but we're more exceptional than you. I don't like the term. I never liked it. When I see these politicians get up with the American exceptionalism, then we're dying. We owe $18 trillion in debt. I'd like to make us exceptional, and I'd like to talk later instead of now. Does that make any sense?
That's good.
Because I think you're insulting the world. And you know, Jim, if you're German, or if you're from Japan, or you're from China, you don't want to have people saying that.
Right.
I never like the expression. And I see a lot of good patriots get up and talk about America. You can think it, but I don't think we should say it. We may have a chance to say it in the not-too-distant future, but even then I wouldn't say it. Because when I take back the jobs and when I take back all that money and we get all our I don't want to rub it in. Let's not rub it in. Let's not rub it in. But I never liked that term. Okay.
Quite a lot to unpack from that statement. Of course, there's a kernel of truth in the explanation there about America being in trouble, you know, $18 trillion in debt. But what's interesting, just a few points to make here, what's interesting is this is Donald Trump in 2015. This was about a month before he announced he made his official announcement to run for president. So he said that going into his run for president, and he's talking there about hearing President Obama talk about American exceptionalism. I mean, when Obama got all the criticism that he did in 2009, he came out later and tried to reassure Americans that, look, I do believe in it. I do believe America is an exceptional nation and that we are established on an exceptional idea. And a lot of the strongest criticism aimed at him in 2009 for that remark about, well, sure, we're exceptional, just like Britain, just like Brits feel they're exceptional, just like the Greeks feel they're exceptional. He, in saying that, the strongest of criticisms was from Gingrich and others who said, I don't even know if he understands what it means, this idea. It's not just that we're great, oh, we're better than you. It's established on an idea that had never been established before. One nation under God. The promotion of liberty and freedom for all peoples. of any race, any religion. And so after the criticism in 2009, you know, President Obama was able to adjust his statement somewhat. But now, you heard it right there in that statement we just played. Mr. Trump saying that when he hears President Obama talking about American exceptionalism, he doesn't like it. So he's somewhere left of President Obama. It's really an astonishing statement. And two, if you see how he explains or talks about American exceptionalism, it's as if it all depends upon wealth. When I go and get all the jobs back, when I take all the money that we've given out, I mean, think about that comment. Once I go and get back what we've given to this world, I want to take everything back from the world that we've given them. That's a direct quote. I want to take everything back from the world that we've given them. And then when we do that, then maybe we will be exceptional. We don't have to go and say it. But when we get the jobs and the money, then that's an exceptional United States of America. It really is an astonishing statement. We've gone through Isaiah 3 quite a lot when talking about the leaders in Israel today, the Israelite nations of Judah, the United States, Britain. And there's a fascinating couple of verses there in that passage, that chapter, about the dearth of true leaders in Israel today. Isaiah 3, verse 5, it says, "And the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. And the child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable." And then verse 6, "When a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, 'You have clothing, you be our ruler, and let this ruin be under your hand.'" I've always thought, well, how bad does it have to be in Israel for this to be fulfilled? Because it seems like there's always people lining up to run for office. I mean, in the Republican side, they had, what, 18 candidates early on in the race? So there was certainly no shortage of applicants. But it's interesting now to see some of the reaction. As Mr. Hilliker brings out in his piece, there's quite a few people on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, who won't even vote for the candidate of their party, who say they're not even going to vote. Consider this statement. This is from columnist Brett Stevens. He said, "The best hope for what's left of a serious conservative movement in America is the election in November of a Democratic president held in check by a Republican Congress." He says, "If the next presidency is going to be a disaster, why should the GOP want to own it?" In other words, here you go, Trump. You be the ruler and let the ruin be under your hand. Well, to be sure, there's going to be an even more dramatic fulfillment of this prophecy here in Isaiah 3. Where the ruin will be so great, no one will want to come forward. But perhaps we're seeing a small bit of it already fulfilled, or maybe the outer edges of it. The Never Trump movement has been talking, it seems, for months about an alternative candidate. I guess most recently it's a columnist, David French, I believe, from National Review. Before that, Mitt Romney's name was put out there. But none of them wanted to come forward for whatever reason. And now some, like Brett Stevens, are concluding, look, if it's going to be a disaster, then why should we want to be any part of it? Stephen says, "For conservatives, a Democratic victory in November means a loss of another election. with all the policy reversals that entails, that may be dispiriting, but elections will come again. As if the dwindling conservative movement in the United States can still turn this all around in 2020. 2020, that's the year. After President Obama's election in 2008, oh, it's all about 2012. Now 2016. Now 2020. Verse 8 here in Isaiah 3 says, "For Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen because their tongue and their doings are against the Eternal to provoke the eyes of His glory." God here speaks of our nation's ruin as if it's already happened. Now more and more commentators are beginning to see that it's so damaged, it's so ruined. Well, let's just let them have Trump, or let them have Hillary, and we'll just start now preparing for the next election in 2020. It's interesting, as I went through these statements, this clip from President Obama, and then Mr. Trump, the one from last year, what John Kerry said a couple of years ago, and you just compare it with the way some of the founding fathers spoke about this American idea, the way they talked about American exceptionalism, even as recently as President Reagan's term in the 1980s, or two terms. He announced his candidacy for president back in 1979, and I mean, at that time, there were quite a few problems in the United States. We were being humiliated by Iran with the hostage crisis that went on for more than a year. Inflation was skyrocketing. Military defense strength had deteriorated, dramatically so. And Reagan, in this speech, again, he's introducing his candidacy, but in this speech, he's talking about how other nations were passing the United States in overall productivity, in industry, in business, in the world markets. America's currency, he said. It was no longer the stable measure of value that it once was. What had happened? How are we going to turn this around? Let me play for you this two-minute clip. This is from President, or then candidate, Ronald Reagan, announcing his candidacy for president on November 13th, 1979.
"But there remains the greatness of our people, our capacity for dreaming up fantastic deeds and bringing them off to the surprise of an unbelieving world. When Washington's men were freezing at Valley Forge, Tom Paine told his fellow Americans, 'We have it in our power to begin the world over again.' We still have that power. We, today's living Americans, have in our lifetime fought harder, paid a higher price for freedom, and done more to advance the dignity of man than any people who ever lived on this earth. The citizens of this great nation want leadership, yes, but not a man on a white horse demanding obedience to his commands. They want someone who believes they can begin the world over again. A leader who will unleash their great strength and remove the roadblocks government has put in their way. I want to do that more than anything I've ever wanted. And it's something that I believe, with God's help, I can do. I believe this nation hungers for a spiritual revival. Hungers to once again see honor placed above political expediency, to see government once again the protector of our liberties, not the distributor of gifts and privilege. Government should uphold and not undermine those institutions which are custodians of the very values upon which civilization is founded: religion, education, and above all, family. Government cannot be clergyman, teacher, and parent. It is our servant, beholden to us. We who are privileged to be Americans have had a rendezvous with destiny, since the moment in 1630 when John Winthrop, standing on the deck of the tiny Arbella off the coast of Massachusetts, told the little band of pilgrims, "We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." A troubled and afflicted mankind looks to us, pleading for us to keep our rendezvous with destiny, that we will uphold the principles of self-reliance, self-discipline, morality, and above all, responsible liberty for every individual, that we will become that shining city on a hill.
Those are words from Ronald Reagan when he announced his candidacy for president in November 1979, quoting from John Winthrop. That famous statement, that vision of being a city on a hill. The eyes of the world are upon us. We've got to set the example. And Reagan brought up America's history there in that statement. How that it had fought harder, paid a higher price for freedom, and had done more to advance the dignity of man than any people who ever lived on this earth. And America's leaders today, most of them, they want to apologize for that. Or they want to pretend that that didn't happen. Or they want to say, well, yeah, it's special, just like people in this nation or that nation think their nation's special. America's founding fathers didn't think that way. They set out to establish this lasting beacon of liberty, a shining city on a hill, a phrase coined by John Winthrop, actually not, a phrase coined by Jesus Christ. And one that President Reagan drew attention to over and again throughout his presidency. What a difference when you compare some of his statements, some of his speeches, with the ones that are in office today or the ones running for office. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Go ahead, set an example so that everyone can see it." That's what Christ went on to say. "Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick. And it gives light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." Let them see your good works. Let them see it. This idea, this noble experiment that freed the continent of Europe from tyranny twice in the 20th century. We just passed the anniversary for D-Day on Monday. I read a few articles on that and listened to some sound bites there. We just didn't take the time to get into that on Monday's show. In any event, any time that you read it, you get emotional. You think about these boys, 18 years of age, coming up to the shore. I forget what those boats are called that transport them, with the door in the front that lowers so that they can run out and onto the beach. And just the bullets that were careening off the metal, that were waiting for that door to swing open, so that these American boys, these teenagers, could be mowed down in order to liberate France, in order to liberate the continent of Europe, in order to fight for freedom. The blood of tens of thousands, millions over the course of that war, spilled because of tyranny. because of Nazism, because of Imperial Japan, because of the cause of these great world wars. And who fought for freedom and liberty? And who stood up to these tyrants? This is a great and noble history, not only for America, for Britain. And those days now seem like they're centuries ago. It was just 70, 75 years ago. God said, "Let your light shine, and do it in a way that they'll see your good works." In Philippians 2, or maybe it's Philippians 4, Paul said, "Let your moderation be known. Let your example, your life of balance, let it be known so that people could see it." Paul said the same thing to Timothy. Be an example to the brethren. That's what President Reagan was talking about. Look, we don't have to apologize for advancing the dignity of man more than any other nation on earth. Let's keep letting the light shine. And let's understand the foundational building blocks of doing that. Religion, education, and family. Very similar words to what the founders would have said. You don't hear anything like that today. Do you think that has anything to do with the problems that are burying our nations? God wants the world to see his good works. God wants righteous conduct to stand out. Look at this sin-sick world. Look at the people of this world. They need light. They need hope. You can follow this example back to the Old Testament when God raised up the ancient nation of Israel. And he said, "You set an example. Set an example. Be a people for me and exalt and magnify my name," he said through the prophet Jeremiah. And be a praise and a glory to the people. They were created to be a praise and a glory to God. That's what it says in Jeremiah 13:11. You can read Exodus 19 as well, where Israel, anciently, they entered into this covenant with God, promising to be a nation of priests, to be a holy nation, to set an example, to actually serve other nations. You think about the ultimate act of service for the people of France or Belgium or whoever. 18 years old, mowed down within a second, so many of them, in the fight to spread liberty. George Washington, getting back to these foundational building blocks, he said, "If in the revolution of ages virtue should give way to the corruption of morals, profligacy of manners, and listlessness for the preservations of the natural and unalienable rights of mankind, then usurpation may arise upon the ruins of liberty." That's what we're seeing in the United States today. Usurpation arising from the ruins of liberty. He wasn't alone. John Winthrop gave a similar warning. The one who said the city on the hill back in the 1600s. The one who said, "Look, the eyes of all the people on earth are upon us. And if we don't uphold our great God, we're just going to turn into a byword throughout the world. We'll be made a laughingstock." Here's more on American exceptionalism, this American experiment from President Reagan's evil empire speech back in March of 1983.
"The American experiment in democracy rests on this insight. Its discovery was the great triumph of our founding fathers, voiced by William Penn, when he said, "If we will not be governed by God, we must be governed by tyrants." Explaining the inalienable rights of men, Jefferson said, "The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time." And it was George Washington who said that of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And finally, that shrewdest of all observers of American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, put it eloquently after he had gone on a search for the secret of America's greatness and genius. And he said, "Not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness did I understand the greatness and the genius of America." America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great.
That's President Reagan quoting from Alexis de Tocqueville, among others, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, William Penn, John Winthrop. That last statement, if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. You could pull that right out of the book of Deuteronomy. Blessed for righteousness, for doing right, and cursed for disobedience. Blessings and cursings. What is the way to obtain blessings, or in the case of America, to hold on to them? Because we receive them. If truth be told, we receive them because of what God promised to Abraham. And all these blessings, we were the recipients of the greatest wealth and power this world has ever seen in any single nation. And yet, when America ceases to be good, you see them ceasing to be great, losing the power, losing the greatness. It's pretty amazing when you go back, and this is not even that long ago, 30, 35 years ago, and you had a president in the Oval Office who just refused to neglect these principles. He would not forget America's history. And you compare it to the leaders today, as I say, it's pretty sobering. In Barack Obama's memoir, by the way, Dreams from My Father, this happened at the same time President Reagan gave that speech there I just played for you, March of 1983. And here's President Obama writing in his memoir. He said, "In 1983, I decided to become a community organizer. There wasn't much detail to the idea. I didn't know anyone making a living that way. When classmates in college asked me just what it was that a community organizer did, I couldn't answer them directly. Instead, I'd pronounce on the need for change. Change in the White House, where Reagan and his minions were carrying out their dirty deeds." That's what needed to change in the eyes of the community organizers of the 1980s. The Marxists, the socialists, the communists. We've got to get rid of Reagan and his minions and those dirty deeds. Let me fast forward to 1989. This is President Reagan's farewell address to the nation, his farewell address to the United States of America, January 11th, 1989.
"This national feeling is good, but it won't count for much, and it won't last unless it's grounded in thoughtfulness and knowledge. An informed patriotism is what we want. And are we doing a good enough job teaching our children what America is and what she represents in the long history of the world? those of us who are over 35 or so years of age grew up in a different America. We were taught very directly what it means to be an American. And we absorbed almost in the air a love of country and an appreciation of its institutions. If you didn't get these things from your family, you got them from the neighborhood, from the father down the street who fought in Korea, or the family who lost someone at Anzio. Or you could get a sense of patriotism from school. And if all else failed, you could get a sense of patriotism from the popular culture. The movies celebrated democratic values and implicitly reinforced the idea that America was special. TV was like that, too, through the mid-60s. But now we're about to enter the 90s, and some things have changed. Younger parents aren't sure that an unambivalent appreciation of America is the right thing to teach modern children. And as for those who create the popular culture, well-grounded patriotism is no longer the style. Our spirit is back, but we haven't re-institutionalized it. We've got to do a better job of getting across that America is freedom. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of enterprise, and freedom is special and rare. It's fragile. It needs production. So we've got to teach history based not on what's in fashion, but what's important. Why the pilgrims came here, who Jimmy Doolittle was, and what those 30 seconds over Tokyo meant. You know, 4 years ago, on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, I read a letter from a young woman writing to her late father, who had fought on Omaha Beach. Her name was Lisa Zanata Hen, and she said, "We will always remember. We will never forget what the boys of Normandy did." Well, let's help her keep her word. If we forget what we did, we won't know who we are. I'm warning of an eradication of that, of the American memory that could result ultimately in an erosion of the American spirit. Let's start with some basics. More attention to American history and a greater emphasis on civic ritual. And let me offer lesson number one about America. All great change in America begins at the dinner table. So tonight in the kitchen, I hope the talking begins. And children, if your parents haven't been teaching you what it means to be an American, let them know and nail them on it. That would be a very American thing to do.
It's a moving address. President Reagan's farewell address. In January 1989, after a year of a decade of changing a lot of what was wrong with America, and as he said, the national feeling is good and our spirit is back, but we haven't reinstitutionalized it. He could see that there were still dramatic changes, changes for the worse happening in the home, in popular culture, in the university, at schools. Well, our spirit is back, but we haven't reinstitutionalized this vision, this city on a hill vision, this American exceptionalism idea. If we ever forget it, we won't know who we are. If we forget about those boys at Normandy, if we forget our history, we're going to lose sight of who we are. He said, "I'm warning of an eradication of the American memory that could result ultimately in an erosion of the American spirit." That's a warning from 1989. Let's get back to basics, he said. Let's get back to basics at the dinner table each night. Let's come together as families. Let's hold to our traditions. That's the American thing to do. There's someone who was who is putting forth some change. These are changes that we can make that will improve our condition. Again, compare and contrast with the changes put forward today, where to some, the American idea just pretty much boils down to jobs and money. Jobs and money. We got to get those jobs back from Mexico or China. And we've got to go take that money that we've given to other nations. And as for the term American exceptionalism, I don't really like it. I don't really like it. Or, well, of course we're exceptional, just like others are exceptional in their nations. Change is coming to the United States, and it's more in alignment with what President Reagan just said there in that farewell address than it is with any other politicians today. Ronald Reagan obviously didn't understand God's truth, God's purpose. But you heard him today. As far as presidents go, he was a good man. In fact, after Herbert Armstrong died, did you know that President Reagan sent a note to the Worldwide Church of God, Mr. Armstrong's church? And he said Mr. Armstrong contributed to sharing the word of the Lord with his community and with people throughout the nation. You can take pride in his legacy. You can take pride in Mr. Armstrong's legacy, said a United States president about Herbert Armstrong. A president that the current president, as it happens, was carrying on dirty deeds in the White House back in 1983. Deeds that needed to be changed. A great transformation is needed. Fundamentally change the United States of America. Well, change is coming, as I say. And in fact, American greatness and exceptionalism will return. Sadly, though, it won't happen until after Jesus Christ returns to this earth. And then there will be, truly, bright days ahead for the United States, for the once Great Britain. After the tribulation, after our peoples have been corrected for their many sins, then God intervenes and restores the prosperity, the greatness, the power, and actually turns our nations into an exceptionally positive example, worthy of praise and honor. It's not going to be Pax Americana or the British Empire this time around, or even President Reagan, or Barack Obama, or Donald Trump. It'll be the King of Kings that will lift all of human life toward a civilization of excellence and prosperity and peace, family, religion, education. It's talked about in so many different prophecies. Revelation 11 and verse 15 is one of them. The kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And he shall reign forever and ever. Now that, like Joel Hilliker wrote in his piece, that is change that you can believe in. That's change you can believe in. Jeremiah 17, the chapter that talks about it being a curse if we trust in a man. It is a curse If you place your faith in a man, if you place your faith in a politician, if you place your faith in a movement, a political movement, you will come under a curse, God says. And yet in that very same chapter, it says, blessed is the man. Blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord and whose hope the Lord is. So where are we placing our trust? That's the question. In whom are we placing our trust? It better be in God, or else we are going to find ourselves in a very difficult and dangerous position. Blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord and whose hope the Lord is. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have time when we come back for just a few closing remarks and a humorous joke that I think you'll enjoy. Stay tuned.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Well, the great thing about searching through President Reagan's speeches when wanting to find some things about American exceptionalism, or even the founders of America, is that when you find the statements or the quotes, there's almost always sound bites with them. And then you can play it like we did here today and hear it for yourself. It's amazing just how much more appreciation that I've had for that president. He left office when I was 18, 19 years of age. And some of you listening out there were even younger than that. Others, I know, have a stronger recollection of President Reagan and what he stood for. And just the fact, as that 1983 speech brings out by its title, the Evil Empire speech, as he's addressing this group of evangelicals, talking about sin, talking about good and evil, talking about the evil spread of communism. Those were bold positions to take. Bold positions that were grounded in that city on a hill idea, in that American exceptionalism idea. And here this same president said that Herbert Armstrong contributed to the sharing of the word of the Lord with his community. I'll conclude today with another clip from that Evil Empire speech. This is actually a joke that he told at the start of the presentation, and the the specifics of the joke aren't necessarily doctrinally sound, but it is funny nonetheless. We'll see you next time.
From the joy and the good feeling of this conference, I go to a political reception. Now, I don't know why, but that bit of scheduling reminds me of a story which I'll share with you. An evangelical minister and a politician arrived at Heaven's Gate one day together. And St. Peter, after doing all the necessary formalities, took them in hand to show them where their quarters would be. And he took them to a small single room with a bed, a chair, and a table, and said this was for the clergyman. And the politician was a little worried about what might be in store for him. And he couldn't believe it then when St. Peter stopped in front of a beautiful mansion with lovely grounds, many servants, and told him that these would be his quarters. And he couldn't help but ask. He said, but wait, how? There's something wrong. How do I get this mansion while that good and holy man only gets a single room? And St. Peter said, you have to understand how things are up here. We got thousands and thousands of clergy. You're the first politician who ever made it.